Hello and welcome to the April edition of the Aldie podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldie. And I'm delighted to have on the programme John Julius Norwich, who has written a terrific piece for the April issue of the Aldie magazine about his great friend Patrick Lee Fermor, coinciding with a new exhibition at the British Museum, Charmed Lives in Greece, about Patrick Lee Fermor and his friends, the artist John Craxton and Nikos Skika. And John Julius, you knew all three of them.
I knew all three of them, yes. I knew Paddy best, but I knew the other three moderately well.
And how did you first come across the great Paddy Lee Fermor?
I came across him, really, because, like I came across so many people for the first time, because they were friends of my parents.
Yeah.
Paddy was a great friend of my mother. And
you explain to the readers and listeners your famous mother, who she was?
Well, she was called Lady Diana Cooper. And my father was called Duff Cooper. He was a politician and a cabinet minister. And my mother was just a very, very remarkable woman in every way. I mean, she really transformed the lives of people around her. I mean, which is a big thing to say, but I think it's actually true. And about three or four years ago, I edited the letters that she wrote to me between when I was 10 and when I was 20. And I think they're as good letters as I have ever read in my life, written to anybody. I mean, they are absolutely marvellous. Half the time she was farming in Sussex, half the time she was flying around the world in the middle of the war with my father. And the letters are equally enjoyable, whichever she's doing. They're absolutely marvellous. It's called Darling Monster, and I strongly recommend it.
Right, certainly, yes. And she introduced you to Paddy, is that right?
She introduced me to Paddy, and in 1955... I was in the Foreign Service in those days, and I'd just gone to work at the British Embassy in Belgrade. And I got a letter from my mother saying, I've just been offered the loan of a Greek boat, a Greek caique, and we're going on a tour in September of the Aegean, and Paddy and Joan are coming, and I hope you'll come too. And two or three other people there. We were eight, I think, altogether. So I said, can a duck swim? You know, it was an ideal answer to what we were going to do on our leave. And so we had this extraordinary two-week trip around the Aegean with Paddy. And with Paddy as not so much as a guide, but it's just somebody being there who knew it all. I mean, first of all, who spoke the language perfectly, who knew all the history, who knew all the culture, who just knew everything. And who just talked as only Paddy could talk. I mean, wonderfully, amusingly, funnily. I mean, nobody has ever worn their enormous erudition more lightly than Paddy did. You know, it was always jokes and it was songs and it was everything was fun.
And incredible knowledge of Greece.
Incredible knowledge of Greece. I mean, there was absolutely nothing he didn't know. I mean, from the classics right the way through to now, you know. And it was the most wonderful experience. And it was that, I think, it changed my life, really, that those 2 weeks did. Because I was already living in Belgrade, so I knew about the Balkans a certain amount.
Yeah.
I'd been there for about 8 months, I think, by then. But this really opened up the Eastern Mediterranean to me and the whole of the Byzantine world.
And this was your first trip to Greece, is that right?
It was my... I'd been there very, very briefly once before, but only to Athens. I mean, I hadn't been to any of the islands or anything. And it was... we had actually stayed the year before... No, we had stayed the year before with Paddy and Joan on Idra, Niko Giko's house. That was in 1954. And we'd just been to Athens and there. But otherwise, I didn't know Greece at all. And I say it was a real eye-opener, and I got very, very excited about the whole Byzantine world, of which I knew absolutely nothing. And Paddy said, if you want to understand about the Byzantine world, there's a most extraordinary book by this man called Robert Byron, who died at the age of 36 in the war. He was torpedoed. And he was extraordinary. He was insufferable in many ways. But he really put the Byzantine world on the map with three or four very enjoyable books, one of which is called The Byzantine Achievement, which was published when he was 25. And it's very much a young man's book. I mean, he goes over the top in many ways. He says, you know, cutting off your nose was so much, such a humane punishment, you know. Well, I mean, compared with burning alive, which is what we were doing, I suppose it was.
Yeah.
Anyway, that opened up the whole of the Byzantine world to me. And subsequently, 20 years later, I wrote A History of Byzantium, which I don't think I'd ever have written if it hadn't been for Paddy and that trip.
How extraordinary. And this exhibition is called Charmed Lives in Greece, and he was immensely charming, Patrick Leigh Fermor. Can you try and unlock his character? Listeners may not know that he left King's School Canterbury under a cloud before finishing and didn't go to university and tramped across Europe.
The cloud was being caught holding hands with a greengrocer's daughter.
Disgraceful, yes, yes.
Disgraceful. Yes.
And then he went on this epic walk across Europe as a teenager, and he was forever exploring across mostly Europe and the greatest travel writer probably of the 20th century. Can you try and explain what was going on in his mind? Was he very, very curious, adventurous? What made him tick, do you think?
He was adventurous. He had this incredible intellectual curiosity about absolutely everything. I mean, the books that this 15-year-old took with him in his rucksack, crossing, we had started with the Odes of Horace, you know, and he was immensely intellectual, but at the same time, he had this extraordinary lightness of touch, so that everything was fun, you know. He never lectured to one or anything like that. I think it was the most extraordinary personality. I mean, it was the sort of personality where people said, do you know, Paddy's coming for the weekend. And everybody said, oh, Paddy's coming for the weekend, how wonderful, you know. And he'd be looking forward to it for 3 or 4 days. From the moment he walked into the room, there was this sort of feeling of electricity in the air. It was, I mean, I haven't known anybody in the world, I don't think, that had it the way he had it. All the time you were conscious of being in touch, not with a genius in any way, he wasn't a genius, but perhaps the most extraordinary person you'd ever met.
And do you think he felt strongly this lack of a formal education? Was that what made him almost an autodidact?
He was an autodidact, completely. I mean, he'd never been to university. He'd been sacked from half a dozen schools, not just King's School, Canterbury. And I don't think he missed the university at all. I don't think he ever regretted not having gone, because he gave himself, he got a far better education from those 3 years, roughly the same time he'd have spent at university, those 3 years going across Europe, learning half a dozen languages on the way, and all the time electrifying the people he stayed with. I mean, I think he had one letter of introduction to some rather dim German baron somewhere, who obviously got a letter saying, oh, said his wife, you know, this young 16-year-old Englishman, I've told Albert we'll have him for dinner, and he can stay the night if he wants to on his way. You know, it's a bit of a bore, but, you know, anyway, we've got to do it. It's over quickly. And then Paddy arrives, and by the next morning they ask him to stay for a fortnight, because he's electrified them all. You know, and then some of them certainly had pretty good libraries. And I mean, the first man would then ring up his friends 20 miles away, 30 miles away, and say, there's this extraordinary young Englishman, do put him up, you know, because you won't regret it. He's absolutely extraordinary and he's fascinating. And this happened. So Paddy, walking across Europe, spent sort of every other night in a four-poster, and every other night under a hedge. he ran the whole sort of gamut. But in many cases, there were these wonderful libraries, and he stayed 2 or 3 weeks with these people. Of course, this is in the 1930s. Everybody had much more leisure time.
Yeah.
And he would stay 3 or 4 weeks and immerse himself in their libraries, which had French books and German books, and probably some English books as well, you know. And he read and read and read, and he had this incredibly retentive mind, which kept everything in his head. He never forgot anything. I never knew him all his life. I never knew him at a loss for a name. I mean, even when he was 92, every name came out like that, you know.
Extraordinary. And this was the kernel for his great trilogy. Would you say he was the greatest travel writer of the 20th century?
I would say equal greatest, with a very different character, but who was a great friend of his, Freer Stark.
Oh, yes.
You would never have a moment worrying which was which. I mean, there's chalk and cheese. But they were very fond of each other. They had an enormous mutual admiration for each other. And I think Frere is the only person I can think of who held a candle to Paddy.
And he has this tremendously rich, ornate prose. Would you agree? How would you describe his prose style?
Yes, well, it is very ornate. I don't know whether it's hard to read, if English is not your native language. It probably is, rather. I remember being absolutely infuriated by listening. It was recorded. Time of Gifts was recorded on books on tape.
Yeah.
And I remember playing it in the car and getting absolutely furious because every single name was pronounced wrong.
How annoying. Yeah.
And Chiaroscuro came out as Chiaroscuro. I remember that. Yes.
And you write in your extremely enjoyable piece about Paddy's, I don't know if you call it writer's block, but that you sort of say he's agonised towards the end of his life because he's written these two volumes and he's spending years, decades trying to write the third, and he was in agony, would you say?
I think he was. I think it really cast quite a thick cloud over the last years of his life. He was always a martyr to procrastination. You know, he would always do anything rather than get on with the job. And writing endless letters or working out extraordinary poems and play on words, you know, and acrostics and things like that, rather than get down to work. And eventually, he suffered all his life, I think, slightly from writer's block. But then ultimately, it became impossible. And he could write little bits. And when my daughter Artemis and Colin Thubron put together all the little bits that they found after his death and made volume 3, it was actually much better, much more readable than I expected it to be. Artemis kept on saying, don't try and compare it with the first two. But in fact, there were so many little bits that he'd written that once they were sort of stitched together, I think it made a remarkable volume. And again and again and again, I mean, there were two or three passages of two or three pages which were just pure Paddy, you know. Yeah. And as good as anything he's ever written.
And what do you think was stopping him? Was it that he had to be perfect and the best was driving out the
Well, it was, you see. I mean, this was a funny thing. He wrote these letters, marvellous letters, to lots of people, including, fortunately, my mother. He wrote her a great many. And these letters were written so fast that, I mean, the fountain pen could hardly deliver the ink quick enough. But when he was writing a book, nothing was good enough. He went over and over and over, correction after correction after correction, you know. And he was a perfectionist to the point where occasionally I think he went over the top and he started making things worse by adding too much and, you know, losing the flow. That didn't happen often, but it did happen, from time to time. But anyway, I say towards the end of his life, I think he realised that he was never going to finish Volume 3. He was, frankly, incapable of it. Well, he was in his late 80s, you know. Well, I'm 88. I mean, he's no older than me. But anyway, there it was. And when he would come to England, as he frequently did, you know, everybody said, oh, how's Volume 3 getting on? When can we expect Volume 3? And it was turning a dagger in his heart, you know, because he just knew that it wasn't coming.
How moving. And it, as well
and he
as
minded dreadfully, I think.
Yeah. And as well as being this terrific writer, he created this extraordinarily beautiful house at Cardamyli in the Marni.
Yes.
Can you describe, as you do in your piece, the process of building the house, which he did practically himself?
He did build it. He did. He had an architect to help him. But most of the basic design was his own ideas. I remember him saying, just when work was starting, he said, if a hen walks into the library, I don't want anyone to notice it. That's perfectly normal. I mean, that's what ought to be happening. Hens ought to be walking into the library from time to time, you know. And Nico Gicca, of course, helped him a lot because Nico was a tremendous influence on over the whole of Paddy's life.
In designing these serpentine
In designing the pebble mosaic floors and things like that, yes.
And it's an enchanting place, isn't it? Can you describe the setting of Cardamyli, his house there?
Well, I mean, when Paddy found the place, it was just about as remote as anywhere in Greece, the middle finger of the Peloponnese. Well, it's in, as it were, the armpit of the little finger, if that is the middle finger, if that's possible to say. And miles away from anywhere, it's an incredible view of the sea and a lovely little island, perfectly placed about 100 yards off the coast, which is a good target to swim to and back and all that sort of thing. And I think for him it was perfection. But then, of course, I'm afraid progress struck, because within 20 years they'd started building a motorway. And now you can actually see a corner, a tiny little bit of the motorway from the house. And it's just made all the difference. You know, I mean, suddenly there were tourists. There was nobody there at all. You never saw a non-Greek. The first 10 years he was there, you never saw a non-Greek face except friends of Paddy's who'd come to stay. And now suddenly, you know, there are tourists and rucksacks and Coca-Cola and all over the works, and a disco at night in the local village.
And we haven't talked about Joan Lee Thurmer, who also was an unusual figure in her own right. In fact, a biography of her came out last year.
Yes, I haven't read that biography, actually. Yeah. But she was interesting, Joan. She always felt that she had to put a little bit of a blanket on Paddy. Not a wet blanket, I don't mean that. But she just had to keep toning him down just a little bit. I mean, sometimes she was perfectly right. At other times, I could have wished that she'd given him his head a little bit more. She wasn't a great conversationalist herself. She was charming and very intelligent and extremely well-read. Again, not as well-read as Paddy, but then who was? But she had this wonderful, rather tired, upper-class voice. Oh, Paddy, really, Paddy.
She put the blanket on what she'd heard the stories too many times before.
I think she'd heard the stories too many times before. Well, I mean, I know that that trouble. I mean, I think my own darling wife has much the same problem.
And we can't talk about Patrick Lee Thurmer in Greece without referring to his most famous exploit on Crete in the Second World War.
The kidnapping of the German general.
And did he talk about that to you?
Never.
Oh, really?
He never, never mentioned it.
How extraordinary.
And hated doing so. When people asked him about it, you could sort of hear him sighing, oh, God, do I have to go through all that again, you know? He never, never talked about it. I think he quite enjoyed when they made a film of it.
Yeah.
And Paddy was played by Dirk Bogarde, who was a great friend and a most delightful man. And they got on terribly well together, were friends for life. But I think he quite enjoyed that, and he went off and helped, you know. And occasionally, there's one marvellous moment when Dirk Bogarde says, after they've been climbing Mount Ida in Crete or something for the last 3 days, and it was boiling hot, he's actually sort of, what I wouldn't give for a lovely glass of clear, cool lemonade. That's not what Paddy would have reacted to at all.
And he didn't talk about it because he told the story too often or because it was too heartbreaking?
Well, he didn't like blowing his own trumpet. He never talked about himself. He never talked about his family. His father was a scientist in India and invented or discovered a new sort of substance. It's called fermerite. I don't quite know what it is. But Paddy never talked about anything like that. He never talked about his childhood. He never talked about his walk, except if something came up that involved mentioning the Great Walk, he would mention it. It wasn't the sort of thing he talked about much, and he never talked about General Cuyper.
How fascinating. And he admitted himself that he did a certain embroidery of his stories when he's writing 30 years on.
Well, 30 years on, you see, and the time of gifts, he lost his diary at the YMCA in Munich. I mean, he'd only got as far as Munich. I mean, not very far. And he lost it, and I suppose he started another one, but I don't know. Anyway, I think he did really start another one, because it was really all memory. And of course, you know, memory after 30, 40 years does play tricks. And Paddy was, you know, I mean, he didn't hesitate to embroider a good story if it could be made better still.
Fair enough.
Now, there's a bit about in Hungary, he said, in the book, actually I walked it was frightfully boring, so I put myself on a horse in the book.
Right. How funny. Yeah. Also here is Annabel Sampson, our digital editor. I wonder if you have a question for John Julius Norwich.
It's been described as being loved by old and young alike. How did your daughter Artemis behave with him?
She loved him dearly from the start. She got to know him through me. I don't know, actually, I can't remember when they first met. I think they met at dinner in our house one time when he was over in London for a bit, and I invited her. And they sort of clicked, you know. And then she went to he invited her to Cardamili. And then as he grew older, and as more and more of his old friends dropped off the hook, particularly after Joan died, but he needed looking after, you know. And there he was, really, by himself. But he had this wonderful lady who helped him, a Greek lady from the village.
But divine Elpida,
who was absolutely wonderful. Yeah. But apart from her, she was no substitute for Joan, God knows who was. But what actually happened was that then sort of two or three nice ladies really took him over and adopted him and looked after him. One of them, whose name I lost, I can't remember, one was the daughter of a previous ambassador, Olivia Stewart, and the other one was my daughter Artemis. And she it was who was carving out a literary career for herself, and asked Paddy if he would allow her to write his life, and Paddy said, of course, how lovely. So then she went even more often to Cardamili and talked and talked and talked, or at least Paddy did all the talking. Artemis scribbled down. And this very successful biography was the result.
Any other question there?
John Humphreys hosted an interview called Man of the Marnie. I listened to it, it's on the Radio 4 iPlayer. An interesting quote says, old hacks like me love exploding myths. And surely the many accounts of the brilliant writer falling in love with the unsophisticated Greek villagers and them falling in love with him must have been romanticised. But everybody he spoke to seemed to think and talk about him with huge affection. Mm. And it sounds like was widely and hugely adored by the locals.
By everybody.
By everybody.
He was. And I mean, the point was that he loved the Greeks. He was only really happy sitting around a little kafana table, you know, drinking ouzo, and talking to them. And, I mean, frequently they were local fishermen, but there was, it comes out in one of his books, Time of Gifts, I think, Mani. One of the fishermen at Cardamili had a good claim to be the last surviving member of the imperial family of Byzantium, the Palaeologus. He was called Palaeologus, and as far as anybody knows, he was, if Zanon was still going on today, he would be the emperor. And on that, Paddy constructed the most wonderful castle in the air of, at the time of the Cyprus crisis, you know, if the Greeks and the Turks came to an agreement on Cyprus, let's just say, and the Turks gave back Constantinople to the Greeks. What an excitement there would be, you know, and here'd be old Costa being carried on a great golden throne, and, you know, Bogomils would be hurling themselves off the battlements, and Stylites would be falling off the top of their columns, and God knows what. It's the most wonderful four or five pages, which, that's I think, one of the most wonderful things about Paddy's writing, when he gets a bit between his teeth, and suddenly, for three or four pages, there's just some absolutely marvellous, inspirational stuff. That's one of them. There's another, also in Mani, there's another a description of what it's like a day when you see dolphins from your boat. Descriptions of dolphins hurling themselves into the air with hysterical abandon in reverse of a suicide from a skyscraper. It's a wonderful idea. Hurling themselves up. Nobody else could have written that, you know.
And he was also very funny, and perhaps we'll finish with, I think I'm right in saying, you and Artemis both spoke at his memorial service.
We did, yes.
And you did a funny skit together. Can you explain
yes.
that?
Well, that was another one of the things Paddy did in order not to get down to work. He translated endless English, old English songs into Greek or into Italian or into French or into whatever language might amuse him, you know. And he did Duquesne John Peel in Italian and Widdicombe Fair in Italian. Con Guglielmo Brua, Giovanni Stewart, Pietro Gurney, Pietro Davy, Daniele Widom, Enrico Hawke, il vecchio zio Tommaso Cobley e tutti quanti, il vecchio zio Tommaso quando e tutti quanti. You know, I mean, it was wonderful. And that was one of the things that he would... You never knew when Paddy wasn't going to burst into song. And Artemis and I... Duquesne John Peel in Italian, that's right, with the names of all the hounds, Ranter and Wingwood, Bellman and True. I can't remember what they were in Italian now. The nice lady who is the vicar of St. James's Piccadilly, I don't know what she thought of it. I think she didn't know what it hit her. I mean, it'd been totally unlike any memorial service she'd ever run in her life before, you know.
Anyway, I think that's a very, very good place to stop. And I'm so grateful to John Julius Norris for his terrific article in the April edition of The Oldie.